You're tuned in to Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio is supported by Compass, the future of real estate in the Metro DC area and beyond. Discover more at compass.com.
You're listening to The Tidbit, brought to you by Curate, live at the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan. I'm your host and CEO of Curate, Kim Bryden. Do you run a small business or have dreams to start one? Well, here at The Tidbit, we've got your back. Each week, we talk through tidbits of knowledge around starting or running a small business with a food and beverage lens. This show is actually based on a biweekly newsletter that we send out at Curate called The Tidbit. And so if you're eager to learn more tidbits of knowledge about the food and beverage industry, starting or growing a business, or even entrepreneurship lessons learned, sign up today. We have a send this week. So head over to curateconnect.com and sign up in the footer, CUREATE connect.com. So I've been thinking a lot recently about solving problems. And whose responsibility is it to solve problems that are facing our world today? Is it the government, the private sector, nonprofits? And I have a feeling that we as a society may feel a bit jaded that certain sectors are no longer serving our needs. And with this sort of change in dynamic as to whom we're holding accountable to uphold these American dream values, we've sort of shifted who we perceive as the entity who is going to build and maintain these sustainable solutions. And I personally think that this burden or responsibility has now sort of shifted to private sector for-profit businesses, which is why, you know, I also believe that we're seeing more and more news articles about building businesses that have both profit and purpose. Profit and purpose. And this is the core of what we're going to be discussing today with our guest, Jeff Cherry, who's the CEO of Conscious Venture Lab and Shift Ventures, which is an accelerator and investment firm for purpose-driven businesses. But before we welcome Jeff to the show, I do want to talk more about our perceived societal problems and which problems get solved. The issue with leaning on private sector too much is that there's no check and balance, right? And those who are in a position of power to build or create solutions oftentimes may not have a wide, diverse perspective or worldview. And so I really believe we need this abundance of creators from different walks of life, creating new solutions. It's not a zero-sum game. And if one person wins, that does not mean that everyone else loses. Creation is expansive. Creation creates more innovations and more exciting challenges to be solved. Fun fact, did you know that texting was originally created for the deaf and hard of hearing community? And so what if we designed with all communities in mind, as opposed to viewing it as designing for disability? I mean, what fantastic solutions we would have, like the groundbreaking, pervasive use of texting. And so, you know, I want us to really think about these aspects of technology and private sector and what it means to build these businesses of the future. I read this New York Times piece titled "The Tyranny of Convenience." And I find it utterly fascinating. I'll link to the article in our show notes on the blog, CUREATE.co/blog, because the whole piece is a great read. But I bring up this article because to me, it seems that our technologies of the past maybe 5 to 8 years have been built around optimizing convenience, you know, tasks your parents would do for you if you still lived at home. Get my groceries, clean my laundry, drive me to school. And I'm just asking the question here, is that really a problem that needs to be solved for? And are we gaining more leisure time or bettering our lives by having more convenience? Just, you know, some things to think about. And so the article reads, quote, Americans say they prize competition, a proliferation of choices, the little guy. Yet our taste for convenience begets more convenience through a combination of economics of scale and the power of habit. The easier it is to use Amazon, the more powerful Amazon becomes, and thus the easier it becomes to use Amazon. Convenience and monopoly seem to be natural bedfellows. Convenience is all destination and no journey. But climbing a mountain is different from taking the tram to the top, even if you end up at the same place. We are becoming people who care mainly or only about outcomes, and we are at the risk of making most of our life experiences a series of trolley rides. So I want you to ask yourself, when you're, you know, experiencing your day-to-day choices, who is building your future? Who is building our futures? Who are we empowering to build solutions? And who is deciding what you believe, what I believe, and how you live out your life? And so I'm really, really, really glad to have a discussion today with Jeff about the importance in investing in purpose-driven businesses and also investing in companies with diverse teams and founders. So we'll be back with Jeff after a quick break.
Full Service Radio is supported by Compass. Discover Compass, America's first modern real estate company. By pairing the industry's top agents with technology, Compass delivers an incomparable client experience from the first-time buyer to the seasoned seller. Visit them today in DC, Maryland, and Virginia, or navigate compass.com day or night.
Hi, Jeff. Welcome to the Tidbit.
Hi, Kim.
How are you? So glad you're here. Beautiful day.
It is. I'm happy to be here.
So a main thread that sort of runs throughout this show has been the importance of defining your purpose and how that purpose will fuel your passion in creating and sustaining business operations. I mean, personally, when I'm feeling the blues and hardships of entrepreneurship, this sort of guiding mission statement for us at Curate, it's creating access to knowledge and new business opportunities for small business owners to survive and thrive. You know, it really gets me going again. I mean, it's a purpose that's bigger than myself. It's a vision and set of values that other people can rally behind. So I'd love to jump off our conversation by asking you, as an investor, why is it so important that this definition of why is brought to the forefront of an entrepreneur's journey? And why is that so attractive to investors?
Yeah, it's a great question, I think, because you sort of answered it, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's the thing that it gets you up in the morning. It keeps you going through the hard times, right? And as an investor, that's really important, right?
Mm.
I mean, great ideas are a dime a dozen. Execution is hard. And, you know, if you don't have that fire, that drive in you, it's hard for you. Some days it's going to be hard to get up, right?
Totally.
And not only that, what do we really want? You know, we're looking to engage all of our stakeholders, to get everyone around us to support us and be excited about our success. You want that as an entrepreneur. I want that for you as an investor, because
mm-hmm.
that makes me more successful. And, you know, purpose is the only thing that does that. You know, your customers don't care if you make money. Your suppliers don't
uh-huh.
care if you make money,
yeah.
right? They care if you care about them. They care about the things that they care about, and they want you to care about those same things. I'm doing a panel in a couple of weeks at Loyola University in Baltimore,
mm.
and the day before is going to be a speech by the guy who started MBAs Across America.
Oh,
and his the speech is purpose is the new bottom line, right? So that's you know, that's what's driving success in the future. That the winners of the future are not going to be those companies that focus myopically on shareholders. They're going to be the companies that find a way to engage us all in things that we really care about. And that's what purpose does.
Totally. I mean, I think you've been such a pioneer in this space with Conscious Venture Lab and other, you know, different funds, Rise of the Rest, Village Capital, even BlackRock
yep.
came out with a piece about the importance of purpose and driving the bottom line.
Yeah.
And so how have you sort of seen in your years of being in this space, how have you seen that change?
Yeah, look, I think it's becoming more mainstream, but it's not mainstream yet. There's still a lot of people out there, even, you know, Larry Fink's letter, he got a lot of pushback on that. People are still talking about that, you know, the CEO's personal preference has no place in business, right?
Oh.
So you're still getting a lot of pushback. It's not, I think that people like you and I, who are so focused on and understand the power of purpose and so focused on doing business for a more societal reason, we see it everywhere because we hang out with each other, we know each mm-hmm. other, and it's important to us. But there's still a lot of people out there that think that business is just about the money. So while it's becoming more mainstream and we're seeing more and more talk of it, and the evidence that it's of its power is pretty stark, there's still a lot of people who, you know, came from the University of Chicago who don't believe.
Mm. Right? Yeah, I mean, even sort of a simple version of this, I teach a workshop on defining your mission and core values as it relates to starting a food business. And I always start with this workshop in the School of Food series that I run, because if I make cookies and you make cookies, and let's just say they're both great tasting cookies, at the end of the day, our why of starting that cookie business is our unique differentiator. I mean, it's ultimately the thing that's going to set our cookie businesses potentially on different trajectories. And so how it just is so crazy to me that people don't see that as it. It's not just your guiding light of getting you up in the morning, but it's marketing. I mean, it's getting people bought into what you stand for.
100%. First, let me apologize to my friend Christina Hakikian at the University of Chicago. Everyone at the University of Chicago is not bad and all about the money. But you're 100% right, Kim. I mean, Simon Sinek has become famous for really good reason, that he figured this out, right?
Yeah, tell us more. Who is this man?
Simon Sinek is an entrepreneur and a writer and a speaker, and he wrote a book called Start With Why, and did a TED Talk on that, which is, I think, either the one, it's certainly in the top five most viewed TED Talks of all time. And the big takeaway from that is people don't buy what you do, they buy why you do it.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what you're talking about. Everyone, if you're going to be in the cookie business, making good cookies is a ticket to the dance. You're not going to be in a cookie business if you don't make good cookies.
Right.
It's like Danny Meyer always says, right? No, Danny Meyer from New York and Gramercy Tavern fame.
Mm-hmm. Shake Shack.
Shake Shack, mm-hmm. Which everyone loves. He's like, look, getting the right food to the right person at the right table at the right time with the right drink at the right temperature, that's 49% of the game.
Mm-hmm.
51% is how do you make people feel?
I love that. Right?
And so if you're in a restaurant business, everyone worth their salt can get the right food to the right person at the right table at the right time, the right temperature, the right drink. And then how are you going to differentiate yourself? Right.
Right.
You know, you were talking earlier about text and convenience and social media. Everything's Instagram. If you come up with a new creative dish, the guy down the street knows it in the next half an hour because his general manager was at your restaurant. He took a picture of it and sent it to you, and you're decomposing it on the spot. So
right.
Competition in terms of product and service is, you know, it's fierce. And the only thing that sets you apart is what do you believe?
Absolutely. Yeah. And then by having that very defined vision and set of values, it of course leads to you having a team that's also bought into that. And I want to sort of lead into that a little bit more, because culture and team building as a result of being a purpose and profit-driven business, you've done a lot of work in creating sort of culture KPIs, key performance indicators, if I, you know, could put it so
right.
that way, on how teams and businesses actually perform way better when these values are upheld by the team. So could you give some examples of businesses who do this well, and how does an entrepreneur even begin starting this process? Because everyone's in this hiring.
Right.
People get scared to bring people into their team in their world.
This is a really, really interesting sort of examination, Kim, and we could probably talk for hours on this. First of all, who does it well? I mean, I think that the sort of our, one of our exemplars in terms of building culture around what you believe is Southwest Airlines. Mm. They do an amazing job. Anyone can't work for Southwest Airlines. You have to really care about that sort of quirky, have that quirky personality and that the way that they want to have fun. It's they've really done a great job at building a culture around the things that they care about, democratizing air travel. They look at to KPIs how we hire people. Then on the other end of the spectrum, you have my friend Mike Brady. Mike Brady runs a thing called the Grayston Bakery in Yonkers.
Mm.
And the Grayston Bakery is pioneering something we call open hiring. Open hiring is you want a job, you come and tell us you want a job, we put your name on the list, and the next open job is yours. That's the interview process.
Wow.
And he has done an amazing job. And Mike always says, I don't hire people to make brownies. I make brownies so I can hire people. And he's done an amazing job at creating a culture there. And I had a discussion with him similar to this a few months ago for Conscious Company magazine. And I was like, Mike, I'm the culture guy, hiring for culture. How do we, how do we make sure we're getting people who believe the same things that we believe? And he said, well, I just don't spend any time weeding people out. I believe everyone is employable. What I spend my time on is actually on building the culture inside the organization.
Amazing.
And then for people who don't match up, they automatically, they opt out. So I think that the first thing for entrepreneurs to think about, and you can, you know, I'm not saying one is better than the other. There's lots of debate about that and lots of room, I think, in between those two things. But the first thing to understand is that culture is tangible, that you can design your culture. I believe you can measure culture. If culture is about, well, I think culture is about behavior, right? Mm. What behaviors do we want? How much of those do we want? How much of the ones we want are we getting? So you can measure that, right? If collaboration, if empathy, if those are things that you, that you feel strongly about in terms of culture, you can measure those. So I think the first thing for entrepreneurs to understand is that culture really is a tangible, we call it, tangible, intangible assets. But culture is tangible, that you can measure it, you can plan for it, you can build it. And
sure.
That's the first thing to remember, I think.
Do you think that, I love this example of the bakery because for them, it's not a part of the interview process, but it's about the day-to-day actions and operations.
Yeah, it's. I think it's fascinating. Yes, that's exactly it. And I like the, part of their culture is that they believe everyone is employable, right?
And by making that statement, what does that do if someone just walking in the door?
Right.
That sense of empowerment.
Sense of empowerment, but it also it translates into the things that they do day to day. Because if everyone's employable, we don't need an interview process.
Ah.
Because everyone's employable.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Everyone may not fit within the Grayston Bakery culture, but everyone's employable and we're going to give you a chance to see if you fit within our culture.
Mm.
Right? So it influences everything that they do.
Right. Well, you've had such a storied history in many different verticals, architecture, restaurants. Yeah.
Yeah.
And like I mentioned previously, part of this was you actually working to develop a book around actually measuring culture. So just tell us a bit more about that experience and sort of what led you to Conscious Venture Lab.
Yeah. So I wasn't an author. I was
a consultant,
I guess you'd say, on a book entitled Firms of Endearment that was written by my dear friend Raj Sisodia, who is a marketing professor now at Babson College. He also wrote, subsequent to that, Conscious Capitalism. The journey from being an architect to then turning that business into a management consulting organization because we were, again, trying to figure out how do we compete, right? And I woke up one day and I looked in the mirror and I saw Jeff Cherry, not Frank Gehry. So I said, so we have to figure out how to compete. And we started to think about how the physical environment influences people's behavior, and we were sort of using that as a tool to compete, you know, to get into corporate America. That led us to thinking about, if we were thinking about how the environment enables or inspires behavior, those behaviors have to be aligned with strategy. So we started to think more about strategy. So we got deep into helping organizations develop strategy. And we just saw this happening naturally, that there were a group of customers that were coming to us and asking us the basic questions: how do we lower costs and raise revenue? There were another group of customers coming to us and saying a whole different set of questions. How do I get my employees to give a damn about this place? How do I get suppliers to feel like partners and not servants? How do I get communities to welcome me in and not put up barriers to entry? How do I get customers to understand I have their best interests at heart? It's not just about a transaction, it's about a relationship. And the companies that were solving for those questions were doing great things in the world, but also were very successful financially. And that was sort of the basis of Raj's work. He started doing research on companies that people love and why do they love them. He knew about the work that we were doing. All of that led me to think about what I really wanted to do with my life. I'm a capitalist, mm-hmm. and sometimes capitalists do stupid things. And we wanted to support capitalists that were thinking differently about the nature of the relationship between business and society.
Yeah, it's like I said at the top of the show. I mean, what problems are we solving for? And right. who is deciding which problems have the importance to be solved or are getting funds allocated to solving? Well, solving, everything's in constant ebb and flow. I don't want to say solving all the time.
Right.
But having the ability to be agile and build, you know, potential new solutions to things. And I love that you brought up the difference in questions being asked from we need to make money to how do we inspire our suppliers to feel like they're partners.
You know, right.
it's a completely different frame of mind, and asking the right question then helps you lead to building a business that's more fulfilling and profitable at the end of the day without asking the question, how do I make money?
Absolutely. It's a different frame of mind, right?
Yeah.
It's a different way of thinking about the world.
Yeah, definitely. Well, we're going to take a quick break. And then when we get back, we're going to get into the nitty gritty of how does one even pitch an investor with a purpose-driven business? So stay tuned. We'll be back. We're back on The Tidbit. We're here with Jeff Cherry, the CEO of Conscious Venture Lab and Shift Ventures, an accelerator and investment firm for purpose-driven businesses. So let's get into the pitch.
Okay.
Investment. So if you had to give sort of this high-level overview and outline of the perfect pitch, what would that entail? I mean, our listeners are either starting the process of you know, beginning their businesses and thinking through their story. And I often see people in pitch scenarios, whether it is for raising money or maybe they're even just having an elevator pitch demo, it becomes a little bit of word vomit sometimes. People are mm-hmm. just like, and then my grandma told me to do, you know, how do we create this clear, concise, perfect pitch outline? What does that entail?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure that I even know all the answers to that. We're all working through that.
Totally.
Every single one of us, we're all entrepreneurs. We're working through that. I've given the perfect pitch seminar for you
at Food
together.
Of Food. You're
and
amazing.
Then I have mentors of my own who say your pitch is horrible.
No.
So the first thing to understand is there's no perfect way to do it, and we're all learning.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that really inspires me to think, you know, relax.
Mm.
You know your business. tell a story like you're telling it to your best friend, right? So that's the first thing. I think people, we get nervous, right?
For sure. For sure. Public speaking is the number one fear.
Right?
Yeah.
So I think we need to sort of take a step back, tell a story like you're telling it to your best friend. And then there's certain things that you just want to make sure that you cover, right? And I think that's where the word vomit comes in. Mm-hmm. Trying to get too much in. But there are certain things that we want to cover. We want to, I tell all of our entrepreneurs, I want you to start with your why. I'm channeling Simon Sinek, but I really do want you to begin your presentation with what's powerful about it to you. Why does it matter to you? Why should it matter to everyone else? Not just about the money, not just about the product, not just about the service, but what do you hope to create in the world?
Sure.
I think that, lots of investors will tell you they don't care about that, but they really do. Even if they don't know it, they get engaged in your story, and then they'll rationalize ways to make it make sense from a financial standpoint. It's a hard thing to do because it's contrary to what we're normally taught.
Yeah, and on the money piece, I mean, at the end of the day, your financial forecast, your numbers need to tell a story.
Right.
And sorry to interrupt you here, but I feel like that is indicative of the entire pitch and story you're then communicating. I mean, you can't just be like, and then I'm going to, problem, solution, numbers, done. It's right. All a part of that bigger story of your business.
Everything's about storytelling, and it's all about telling a story. And here's one of the things that I tell our entrepreneurs all the time, and I think that everyone should get their head around this. When someone's giving a pitch to me, there's only one thing I know for certain. Their numbers are wrong. That's the only thing I know for sure. That's what we call them projections.
Right.
We think, here's a rationale, but I know that they're not right. So what I want to know the story behind how you got there. What's your rationale? How are you thinking? That's more important to me than the absolute numbers. Is it a big market? Yes. I want to know that. Right. Is it a real problem? Right. Is it a problem that you know other people have? And how do you know that? I want to know that. There's a lot of companies, as you know, out there are, a problem, solutions looking for a problem.
Yes.
Right. It sounds great, but nobody wants it. Mm-hmm. Right. So is it a real problem that real people have? Will it have an impact on society? Right. So those are sort of some of the basic things. Oftentimes, and here's the sort of flip side of mission-driven entrepreneurs, in a pitch, they'll forget to tell us, how do you make money?
Mm.
Is it a subscription model? Is it B2B? Is it B2C? How do you sell it? How do you get to market? So those are sort of the basics. Why am I doing this, right? What's the story about that? Why is it compelling to me? What's the market? Is it a big market? Is it a problem that real people have, that real people care about, that real people want solved, right? How do we make money, right? What's the rationale for our numbers, right? I know the numbers are not correct, but if you give me your, the backstory about how you came up with those numbers, why do I think I can get this many customers? Everyone says, there's a billion people in China, so if I get 1%, I'm going to make $1 billion.
Oh, don't even get me started. Yeah. Right? How many times I hear I'm just going to pick a random category. Ice cream is $1 billion industry and I'm going to capture 2% of it. And I'm like, well,
right.
I actually want to know, there are 50 grocery stores in the DC area. I am confident that we can land 4 of those 50 accounts. On average, they're going to spend X amount week over week. That's interesting.
Absolutely.
Not like, the global ice cream market.
You're 100% right. And and I think that that's a really, and even you're very good at this. And even that description you gave, I would have jumped in and said, we're confident that we can get 4 of those 4%. Why are you confident? What gives you that confidence? Oh, I forgot to tell you. I've gone out and I've talked to half of those grocery store general partners, general managers, and they said this to me, and therefore I think now that's an interesting story.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, I am a big fan of having more targeted micro community strategy, especially when you're starting up, because you can't build something for everyone. You get no one.
Right.
And so if you're thinking, oh, I'm gonna dominate the snack market nationwide, it's like, you kind of need to build your base of brand loyalists and followers in your geographical metro area first. And how are you tackling that? Like, you need to start small and think in this agile way before you're like, and I'm going to need millions of dollars in fundraising to just blow it out, like nationwide distribution. It's too much. It gets people overwhelmed too quickly without actually understanding what is the problem first and who is my target customer.
I think that you're hitting this on the head, Kim. I think that, you know, when Simon talks about, start with why, how, what, he goes through the, you know, what we call a golden circle. Mm-hmm. Why are you in business? How you expect to achieve that in the world, and what do you do? Mm-hmm. I think in the scenario of a pitch, what people skip over often is the how. And that's what you're talking about.
Yes.
How am I going to get 4% of all the grocery stores in Washington, D.C.? How am I going to get to, 1% of everyone in China? If you start to think about that, how am I going to do that? You would set that aside pretty quickly.
Ooh. Because
you would say, well, there's no way I'm going to be able to do that at this point in my development. So that would lead them to answers more towards what you're saying. How am I going to capture the most readily available customer set? What are the specific things that I'm going to do? I think that's really one of the pieces that if you give that in the pitch, if you tell people why you care about this, what you hope to create in the world, right? What the big problem is, and how do you know other people have it? And then how are you going to get those people engaged in your success,
mm-hmm.
right? Specifically, how are you going to do it? Social media, what does that mean? How many posts? How many posts a week? How many posts a day? How are they, what are the metrics that you've seen that those posts are being, responded to? Those sorts of things. Investors respond to that, to sit back and say, okay, you've thought critically about this.
Mm-hmm.
I may like this business. I may not like this business. I may agree with your conclusions, or I might not agree with those conclusions, but at least I know you've thought critically about it. And that's a long way to getting people on your side.
Totally. And just to piggyback on the social media comment as a tactic, why do you have to think about deploying a strategy for a whole year? Maybe it's, I did this 3-month test. We posted 2 to 3 times per week. By doing that, we got X amount of email inbound inquiries, and 3 of them became customers.
Yes.
How are we creating these micro tests? And it's not fail or success, right? It's just a constant learning process.
Yes.
And for some reason, I think people are so concerned about having the perfect tactic or perfect, silver bullet solution that they get afraid to doing these micro tests. And I just really, big fan of the micro tests, everyone.
Yeah.
Just give it a go. Try it.
Give it a go.
Yeah.
I couldn't agree more. Yeah.
So if our listener is, currently has or is in the process of starting a business and wants to learn more about this access to capital that has more intention behind it, more purpose behind it, where can they find you? Because your next Conscious Venture Lab Accelerator is coming up. So tell us more about that. What is it about?
Yeah, so we're going to launch the call for applications for the fourth cohort, a Conscious Venture Lab, probably within the week.
Ooh.
And they can find that on consciousventurelab.com.
Awesome.
Also, most entrepreneurs that are thinking about applying for an accelerator know F6S, F the letter F, the mm-hmm. number 6, the letter S.com is an application site that most accelerators around the world use. So you can find this there as well.
Oh, great resource.
And we're focused on, urban issues, urban resilience. I'm a city kid. I love the city. I love everything about the city. But also, we think that's where the big, serious, sort of intractable problems are continue to manifest themselves.
Right? Can you define urban resilience a bit more?
Yeah, I think it. Anything that, there's more people moving into urban areas all the time, and our infrastructure is becoming more stressed. So when there are sort of out of the box events like Snowmageddon or like,
sure,
you know, right? Hurricanes and, all, you know, we've had, what, three nor'easters in the last 11 days here? Those things put stress on cities. And the cities who have found a way to either become more smart or more inclusive mm-hmm. are finding also ways to deal with those stresses. So that's what we mean when we mean urban resilience. Those cities that are being more smarter, really smart and inclusive. That's what we're looking at most. So smart cities, technologies, poverty alleviation, closing the wealth gap, those sorts of issues. Those cities that have found a way to bridge that gap between using data and technology to bring people closer together in lots of different ways, both in community, but mm-hmm. also in opportunity and access, are becoming the more resilient cities, meaning they're able to handle stresses better.
Yeah, and you're empowering people with dollars and knowledge from a diverse set of backgrounds. And I think that, again, it's what we discussed at the top of the show, is that your worldview and the problems you have in this world are unique to you and allow for you to build solutions that maybe somebody else didn't even know was a problem. And I just appreciate that about you so much, is that you're bringing this perspective of how are we empowering and channeling money to a diverse set of founders and teams.
Yeah, so you're alluding to the fact that, you know, we planted our flag, the Conscious Venture Lab, in West Baltimore, across the street from Mondawmin Mall, where the riots after the Freddie Gray incident broke out. And we did that on purpose. We did that because we are looking for those diverse entrepreneurs. We're looking to bring entrepreneurs into communities where they may not have thought about going before. And we're looking to find those issues that are bubbling up in those communities, because those are real issues that affect people's lives every day. And the people best able to solve those are going to be the people that are closest to them.
Definitely. Do you have any examples of companies that you're excited for us to keep our eyes on?
Yeah. So we talked about this a little. You and I got to catch up beforehand, which was great. I love a company that we just invested in called Treason Toting Company.
I love them.
They're great guys. They're they're bringing sort of design and manufacturing back into Baltimore. Their office is now in West Baltimore. I think that they have there's a lot of potential there. I really love this other company we just invested in called The Cube Co-Working Space. It's a co-working space for moms or for more broadly for parents. Mm-hmm. And Tamira Lucas is the CEO and founder. And the great thing about what she's doing is she's not trying to go downtown and compete with WeWork. She's actually going into communities like West Baltimore, like Towson, where she knows that there are people out there trying to do interesting things. They're, they may be single parents. They don't have the resources to drive downtown. They don't have access to public transportation. So she's locating in communities and providing the same level of services. So I think that that's a really interesting model that has the potential of impacting thousands of lives, millions of lives, if she can scale it. So those are the sort of things the sort of companies that we look for.
I love that, and we'll link to both of those companies on our blog so that you can check them out further. And like I said earlier, this show is based on our biweekly newsletter that we send out at Curate. So sign up for the newsletter, head to our blog, subscribe to this show in iTunes as a podcast.
And come down to the line and stand around and watch.
Yeah.
Kim, I love the studio.
It's amazing. Yeah. Tune in live. And so we're just so glad to have had you here today, Jeff. And we'll send people to the site if they're interested in applying for the next cohort. And so everyone, until next time, remember to scale thoughtfully and source locally.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter at @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook at Full Service Radio. Thanks for listening.